For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Red's on holiday at the moment, so it's me, Robert Kirkwood, sneaking out from behind the scenes to present this week's show. And coming up today, some great book recommendations and a look at mindfulness. Dr. Ranj Singh will tell us about his new book, Brain Power. I'll ask some talking books narrators for the best book they've ever read. We'll talk to Professor Richard Wiseman about fear and a tip that's guaranteed to make you smile. And we'll return to Dr. Ranj for the books of his life. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Why do some skills come to us more easily than others? How do you cope with knockbacks and deal with challenges? Why do we feel certain emotions? And how do we manage the difficult ones? How do we keep our brains in top condition for learning? In his new book, Brain Power, Dr. Ranj is here to inspire all young readers to love themselves, however their brains work. Dr. Ranj Singh is an NHS paediatrician and one of the resident doctors on ITV's This Morning. He can also be found on BBC's Morning Live, The One Show, and on ITV's Save Money, Lose Weight, Save Money, Good Health, and Dr. Ranj On Call. He'll join me in a moment, but first let's hear a clip of the book read by Dr. Ranj himself.
In 1649, a French philosopher called René Descartes came up with the idea that while your brain controls your body, your mind is something separate. Not literally separate. He didn't mean it was hanging out of the back of your head, but he meant separate in the sense that your mind seems to be bigger than your brain. Your mind somehow takes up your whole being. Brains are the future. All of these discoveries have taught us about how amazing your brain and mind are. So much so that scientists have been trying to recreate what the human brain does in machine form. Have you heard of something called artificial intelligence, or AI? Imagine it's the 1940s during the Second World War, when the Nazis of Germany were fighting against lots of other countries. The Nazis would communicate secretly using a special code made by a machine called Enigma. However, an amazing British mathematician called Alan Turing invented a computer which cracked that code, and that breakthrough helped win the war. Yes, Alan Turing is probably the most awesome Alan in history. He changed history a second time when he wrote about the possibility of creating machines that think like humans. And his initial insights eventually led to the creation of artificial intelligence, computers that think a bit like human brains do. But your brain is much more complex and much more powerful than the world's best supercomputer. No machine currently exists that can do everything your brain does. Artificial intelligence is getting more sophisticated every day, though. If you've ever used Siri, Alexa, or Google Assistant, then you've been using something that is based on artificial intelligence. Who knows what AI will be able to do in the future?
Brain Power is the ultimate brain training / learning and mental well-being guide for kids. It's aimed at children aged 7 and up, and it's full of just fascinating facts about your brain and how it works and how different people's brains work differently, but also how to look after it, how to get better at learning, how to find out the kind of intelligence and learning type that you have and build on that. And also there's a huge section on looking after your mental well-being, practical advice of things you can do to look after yourself, but also things to look out for when it might not be going to plan, and encourages people to seek help when they're really, really in trouble. So yeah, so it's kind of like a little help kids back up, back on track after the pandemic guide.
Why am I so clued up about brains? I've been a doctor for 20 years, and that means I know a little about how the brain works and how to help when things don't quite go to plan. However, I started learning about the brain properly when I went to university. I even did a project where I spent a lot of time cutting up rats' brains. Yuck! Now, as a doctor who treats children and young people, I look after people whose brains may be hurt or not working properly. I also care for people who are struggling with their mental health.
There was one thing that really came across, that you're hammering home the message that we all think in very different ways.
Yes. So we talk about intelligence, for instance, in the book, and we talk about how there are 9 different types of intelligence. And some people are naturally better at bookwork, but some people are better at art and creative things. Some people are musically minded. Some people are amazing at dance. Some people are amazing at social skills and understanding people and getting on with people. And one person can have different types of intelligence, but it's the, I suppose, bring home the point that intelligence isn't just about facts and figures and knowledge. It's about so much more than that. And it's about finding the type of intelligence that you are naturally born with and the gifts that you have and building on those and making those incredible and using them to your advantage, because we've all got them. No matter how our brains work or who we are, we've all got these strengths that we just, if we find them, we can make the most of them.
And that's why IQ tests have kind of fallen out of favour, because they only measure one type of intelligence.
Exactly. IQ tests were developed a long time ago. There's a long history that we talk about in the book about them. And they were used as a measure of intelligence, but they only look at very specific things. And actually, what we now know and we now understand, and I'm glad that we accept, is that different people's brains work differently and we can have different kinds of intelligence. And just because you may not be good at a test doesn't mean you aren't amazing at something else. And that's one of the messages I'm trying to get through in the book, is that no matter who you are as a young person or what you're born with or how you're born and what your background might be, you have strengths, you have skills that you can use and build on and be just as amazing as anybody else.
Now, you mentioned the pandemic. Do you think that affected mental health, and it's now quite an important time for the book?
Yeah, that's kind of where the book was born from. I was thinking, you know, young people and children who I look after in my medical profession, they've been affected so significantly by the pandemic. Their learning has been affected, their education and their mental well-being. And I wanted to sort of write something, a guide, a helping hand that would get them back on track. So this book, Brain Power, is full of not just facts and figures about how wonderful and amazing our brains are and how they work, but actual practical tips and exercises to build your brain power, to get better at learning, to get quicker and faster at things like maths and lots of other funny activities that we do. But also looking after your mental well-being. So looking, building your resilience, looking after yourself, taking time out and thinking about your thoughts and feelings, and above all, asking for help when you're in trouble.
And you also touch on special needs and learning and autism and dyslexia. Yes. It's important to touch on all these facts because, as you say, we all think in different ways and some people may need additional help.
Absolutely. I wanted this book to speak to everybody, no matter who they were or what they were born with or what their abilities might be. I wanted to explain also to everybody else about neurodiversity and about different people's brains and different people's needs and how we all need to understand each other, but also recognize that each one of us is unique and has unique abilities and strengths. So we've got these fascinating insights from neurodiverse young people. We've got an amazing sort of mini essay from an autistic person. We've got some thoughts from somebody who's got ADHD. I talk a lot about dyslexia in the book, and the book is written in a dyslexia-friendly format to make it easier for people with dyslexia to get on board and to engage with it, because they can find things tricky. But also we talk about certain medical conditions that impact your brain and how that may make things work differently. For instance, cerebral palsy or epilepsy. And I've got great examples of people whose brains work in different ways, but they've been and done amazing things. So the guy that invented Pokemon, for instance, is autistic. And the whole idea came from his love and fascination of insects. We talk about one of my all-time heroes, Rosie Jones, who's got cerebral palsy. And she is one of the best and most successful comedians on TV right now. And no one would have expected that from her. But it's to show kids and young people that no matter who you are, you can be amazing. And I'm going to give you some tips and tricks and hopefully some inspiration in how to do that.
And we are on the radio station of RNIB, and there have been some fascinating studies about how brains in people who were born without sight are different from people who perhaps have lost their sight later in life.
Yes, yes, it's a fascinating area of research, actually. So the thing about people who have difficulty seeing, difficulty with their vision, or are born blind, is that there's two things that could be affected. It could be your eyes, or it could be your brain itself. And when we look at the brain itself, you may see evidence of why you've got blindness there. For instance, if you've had an event that's happened when you're inside the womb, for instance, or just around the time that you were born, like a stroke or damage to the brain, you may see evidence of that. But the other thing that we know is that people who are born blind or born with difficulties with vision, some of their other senses get heightened, particularly their hearing, for instance, let's say. And the reasoning behind that isn't just because you are then focusing on that sense. It's your brain rewires itself to make that sense more sensitive. So when you look at the area that processes hearing in people who are born blind, you'll see that it's much greater developed, and it functions in a much better way than people who aren't. And that's why they are so good. That's why their other senses are so good. For instance, hearing is because their brains adapt. And we see the same adaptation happening in people that lose their sight later in life as well. That can happen. And it's a fascinating insight into how our brains are malleable. They change and they adapt depending on what our needs are.
Now, talking of sight loss, you narrated the audio version of Brain Power. How was that?
I was really, really keen on doing an audiobook version because I wanted this to be accessible to everybody. So I know that some young people enjoy books by audio better, and others need audiobooks depending on what their needs and abilities might be. So I really, really wanted to do this, and I'm proud of doing it. It's a completely different kettle of fish to writing it, because when you write a book and you read it, you get a sense of a person's voice and their personality. But when you speak it, when you create an audiobook, you really have to put your energy and emotion into it. And I think it gives you a whole other experience, actually, because you're hearing it from the horse's mouth, as it were, and you're hearing the little nuances and the feeling and the emotion behind it. You get that right from the author. And I don't think there's anything else quite like that.
Do you like audiobooks yourself?
I do. Do you know what? I find sometimes it's easier to engage with a book via audiobook because it means that I can be on the move and on the go and have it in my ears. So I can do it as well as doing something, or I can be in the car and have the audiobook on. I find sometimes it means that I can read more, ironically, by listening to it rather than taking the time to sit down and physically read a book, because I don't always have time to do that.
Brain Power, a toolkit to understand and train your unique brain, is out now, available in print and in audio. Just before you go, give us one tip to keep our brain in top condition.
Ooh, one tip to keep your brain in top condition is exercise. Not exercising your body. I'm talking about exercising your brain. Do activities that keep it active. So things like not just reading and writing and maths and stuff like that, not your traditional learning. I'm talking about crosswords, puzzles, jigsaws, art and creative activities, being sociable, being friendly. All of these things keep your brain active. And that's hugely important all the way into old age.
We all know that being healthy and looking after your body is important. That's what we call physical health. But what about your mind? Well, looking after your brain and mind is just as important, so they can work correctly and we can live happy lives. That's what we mean by mental health. It's about how you feel and deal with all the things in the world. I've had times when my own mental health hasn't been great and I got through it. It wasn't always easy, but I'm in a much better place now, and I'm here to tell you all about it. I want you to remember that however you feel or whatever is happening in your life, you're never alone. And there is always someone to help if you're finding things tough.
Brain Power by Dr. Ranj, a toolkit to understand and train your unique brain, is available in print and audio now. And Dr. Ranj, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Talking books narrators are perhaps the keenest and most careful of readers. When they read a book out loud in studio, it's perhaps the third or the fourth time that they have experienced that text from cover to cover, working on pronunciations, tricky sentences and accents for all of the minor characters. So, at a very noisy gathering of narrators, I felt fairly confident I'd be recommended some amazing talking books when I asked them about the best one they have ever narrated.
One of the good things is that RNIB has a kind of collective memory.
Christopher Oxford.
And if you've done one in a series of books, as for example the Patrick O'Brien books, they remember that and they call you back to do them on another occasion. So I've recorded now probably four or five of the Patrick O'Brien series, and of course I'm looking forward to completing the series eventually. And you keep in your mind, in your memory bank, a store of characters that you can reanimate for each new book that you do, and that's lovely because it gives a sense of continuity. So that's one that I would remember in particular.
HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. But I put it to you, my lord, that prize money is of essential importance to the Navy. The possibility, however remote, of making a fortune by some brilliant stroke is an unparalleled spur to the diligence, the activity, and the unremitting attention of every man afloat. I am sure that the serving members of the board will support me in this, he said, glancing round the table. Several of the uniformed figures looked up, and there was a murmur of agreement.
Going back to our old days at Listening Books, where you and I worked together, we recorded the Philip Pullman, His Dark Materials trilogy, which I remember with particular pleasure because there were so many different characters, and it was so well written by a teacher who'd often had to tell these stories to kids, that I found that a very positive and rewarding experience as a performer, interpreting all the different characters.
Christopher Oxford was reading HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. It's 14 hours, 7 minutes long, and the catalogue number is 14315. Next up, Stephanie Beatty.
One of them for me has to be my favourite of all time is Gillespie and I. I just love it. It's set in Glasgow at the time of the Great Exhibition of 1888. It's a thriller. It's got tremendous twists in it. It's hilariously funny. There's a particular scene set in Hampstead Pond with somebody swimming. I will say no more than that because I don't want to give anything away, but it is a scream. And it's a huge tome. It's not one that you can easily read in bed, but you can easily listen to it and lose yourself in it. That's got to be it.
Fresh air was what I craved. Fresh air and distraction. To escape the odour of hothouse funeral flowers and to purge my mind of bad memories. As you may remember, the first Glasgow International Exhibition was staged in the year 88. For several months, the newspapers had talked of little else, and it occurred to me that some solace might be found in a sojourn to the magnificent spectacle that was said to bestraddle both banks of the River Kelvin. Thus, in the second week of May, having closed up my aunt's little house in Clerkenwell, I took the train to Scotland.
Gillespie and I by Jane Harris, read by Stephanie Beattie, lasts 17 hours and 50 minutes. It's talking book number 18842. Now, visually impaired narrator Giles Abbott tells me about his favourite, a Will Self book called The Butt, An Exit Strategy.
There were places in which the writing was breathtaking. There were also incredibly long, multi-clausal sentences and some very long made-up names. And he's living in a world whereby smoking is now a capital offence, smoking in public or something like that, I forget. His life is turned upside down. He ends up in this very strange... There's a strange traditional society where he's staying, which is kind of Australia and kind of Iraq and kind of all sorts of places. And it's all about how do you accommodate for different cultural practices and how much do you and how much should you. And it's wonderfully weird. And yeah, his life is turned horribly upside down. More characters than you could shake a stick at. So, you know, I'd read, but every time I came to a new character, I just thought, okay, here goes. And just sort of did something different with my vocal anatomy. I'm also a trained voice teacher, so I can pull various stunts with my with the old poets, you know what I mean? And so it was a fun challenge. It was the first one, so I guess that sticks in the mind.
The whole garish infrastructure of this public health campaign appeared, even to Tom's indolent ethical eye, to have been imposed on the country's polyglot and heavy puffing population, in place of any more commanding civic morality. And so it all had grated on Tom, turning those little interludes of cloudy self-absorption into hurried and unsatisfying liaison with La Divina Nicotina. Yes, giving up would free him from such bondages, while, at the same time, he would find liberation in doing the right thing, facing up to his mortality, his responsibilities as a father, a husband, and a citizen. No longer would he sustain his individualism with such puerile puffing.
Giles Abbott was reading The Butt, an Exit Strategy by Will Self. It lasts 12 hours, 6 minutes, and it's catalogue number 16236, and it contains language that might be considered offensive. Now, Christopher Ragland tells me about a few books that have stuck in his mind.
I've done a few biographies, which were quite cool. There was a biography of Dave Grohl, who's the lead singer for Foo Fighters, and that was a really interesting, especially for anybody who likes music, because he has such a love for music, which is fantastic. There was a long one called Matterhorn, which is about the Vietnam War, a kind of semi-autobiographical account of that, but a fictional story, and that's fantastic. And 127 Hours, if anybody wants to read about a guy having their arm almost... eventually torn off after a while. So all of those were quite fun to quite get into.
I know in 127 Hours it's hard to read, it's hard to watch in the film. How was it to narrate?
Hard as well. I mean, especially when you got to the point where he's doing the things that he's having to do to himself. And it's a bit... I would say the hardest part about that book, actually, is he really describes... He makes a video at one point to his parents and having to try and get yourself in the position where you're making that video for your parents saying, I'm going to be dead when you find this. That was quite intense. And then when he described cutting through his arm, which as you do on a normal day. But yeah, it was all quite cool.
On Sunday, April 27th, 2003, 27-year-old Aaron Ralston set off for a day's hiking in the Utah Canyons. Dressed in a t-shirt and shorts, Ralston, a seasoned climber, figured he'd hike for a few hours and then head off to work. 40 miles from the nearest paved road, he found himself on top of an 800-pound boulder. As he slid down and off of the boulder, it shifted, trapping his right hand against the canyon wall. No one knew where he was. He had little water, he wasn't dressed correctly, and the boulder wasn't going anywhere. He remained trapped for 5 days in the canyon. This is the account of those 5 days, of the years that led up to them, and where he goes from here. This book contains language and passages of a disturbing nature that might be considered offensive.
It really, really does. 127 Hours Between a Rock and a Hard Place by Aaron Ralston is 12 hours, 35 minutes long, and it's talking book number 18599. Next up is Frances Jeter, who was recently on the Talking Book Show chatting about one of her favourites, I, Coriander by Sally Gardner. But I asked her to recommend something a bit more grown up.
Oh gosh, I've been reading for the RNIB for a very, very long time, and I think my very favourite book I ever did was Antonia Byatt's Possession, which is a fantastic novel. And to get the chance to read something as beautifully written as that, it's just a treat to read those words.
The book was thick and black and covered with dust. Its boards were bowed and creaking. It had been maltreated in its own time. Its spine was missing, or rather protruded from amongst the leaves like a bulky marker. It was bandaged about and about with dirty white tape tied in a neat bow. The librarian handed it to Roland Mitchell, who was sitting waiting for it in the reading room of the London Library. It had been exhumed from locked safe number 5, where it usually stood between Pranks of Priapus and The Grecian Way of Love. It was 10 in the morning, one day in September, 1986.
Francis Jeter was reading Possession by A.S. Byatt. It's 22 hours and 33 minutes long, and its catalogue number, 8241.
The last book I narrated for RNIB was called The Song of the Clyde, which was, as you might guess, about shipbuilding on the River Clyde from 1700 and something up until the present day.
David Monteith.
I requested to read it because my grandfather worked in the shipyards. He started in the shipyards in 1920, and stayed with one company until the outbreak of the war. So it felt very personal to me. I loved doing it.
Do you think it gave you more of an insight into him?
I think it did. It was fascinating to find out. I mean, it wasn't specifically about the yard. He was with Yarrows. It wasn't specifically about Yarrows. It was broadly the whole history of shipbuilding on the River Clyde in Glasgow, where I'm from. It covered so much that with each chapter, it developed a story that I was already interested in. So, yes, it probably did teach me a great deal more about what he would have gone through when he was an apprentice up to becoming he ended up as a marine architect. So that's The Song of the Clyde.
Shipbuilding in Glasgow is a complex web of relationships and is not something easily or succinctly defined. However, bearing in mind the need to describe these yards, it will be better if we consider first those on the north bank within the city boundary, and also those easily reached by employees domiciled in Glasgow. By 1818, the industrial developments of the city made themselves felt on the riverfront, and in that year, one of the first properly organised shipyards was established in the city when John Barclay feud, a Scots word akin to renting, some ground at Stob Cross.
Song of the Clyde, a history of Clyde shipbuilding by Fred M. Walker, is read by David Monteith. It lasts 12 hours, 36 minutes, and it's talking book number 20157.
I've recently started doing the Juliette Marillier books.
Laura Hutchinson.
And I really like them because they're set in like 9th century Ireland. And that's actually been my favourite ones, because before I was doing more the Marian Keys kind of chick flick kind of books, and I really like doing the mystical kind of, but sometimes the producers, who are guys, don't really get it so much, but the girls do. They really sometimes really get the story and really enjoy that, so that's fun when there's a real history and background to something.
Child of the Prophecy, Book 3 of the Seven Waters Trilogy by Juliette Marillier. Every summer they came. By earth and sky, by sun and stone, I counted the days. I'd climb up to the circle and sit there quiet with my back to the warmth of the rock I called Sentinel, and see the rabbits come out in the fading light to nibble at what sparse pickings might be found on the barren hillside. The sun sank in the west, a ball of orange fire diving beyond the hills into the unseen depths of the ocean. Its dying light caught the shapes of the dolmens and stretched their strange shadows out across the stony ground before me. I'd been here every summer since first I saw the travellers come, and I'd learned to read the signs.
Laura was reading the final book in the Seven Waters trilogy by Juliette Marillier called Child of the Prophecy. It's 23 hours and 33 minutes long, and its catalogue number 20112. I'm asking Talking Book narrators for their favourite books, and some of the answers aren't always what you'd expect.
That's a really difficult question because I read all sorts of books. I think one of the ones I enjoyed most was Mills and Boone, which was called Taken by the Viking, which was quite racy. Meant I had to find out all about Scandinavian pronunciation, but was great fun to do.
Sherry Beans.
In the green room between sessions, you can always tell who's just been doing a slightly racy scene. People are sitting there quite flushed and blushing and saying, oh yes, we've just done our sex scene for the day. So it's quite funny. If our readers, our listeners, could overhear some of the conversations we have in the green room, I think they would really quite enjoy that.
Home at last, Thran said, as the golden serpent slid onto the sandy shore. I can't believe how much I missed it. I cherish every day I spend here. Harkon breathed deeply, savouring his first steps back on his land. All his muscles sighed as he was able to stretch for the first time since they had left Lindisfarne. No, you were the lucky one, the one who goes out adventuring, seeing new lands, meeting new people, gaining treasure. But I never forget this fjord and the estate on the headland. It is what gives me a reason for living. There was something special about his lands and the scent of pine trees that greeted him. This was home, and he knew every inch of the ground.
Sherry was reading The Mills and Boon, Taken by the Viking, by Michelle Stiles. It's 9 hours 22 minutes long, and it's Talking Book catalogue number 15551. Now, sometimes narrators are introduced to new genres that they normally wouldn't read. Here's Eric Myers.
Philip K. Dick, his series of short stories. I had a joy doing those. And I never realized that I was somebody who might be interested in elements of science fiction. And his writing I found very refreshing and, you know, unique. So I was more interested in clever and psychological pieces of science fiction after that. So reading that, and I'm glad it was suggested to me.
And sometimes narrators have simply done too many books to recommend a favourite. Here's Hayward Morse.
There are several I do, although we may not realise it by the way I speak naturally, but I spent a lot of time living in North America, so I've done mainly American books for the RNIB, and some of them have been terribly interesting. Usually it's very interesting when you get to know books and books that sell and books that don't sell, and quite often they're the books that aren't terribly popular or very well known but are really imaginatively written and perhaps a bit surreal and quite unusual, and yet they're not bestsellers or popular in that way. I think, if anything, that's what I've usually found about the books that have interested me. They're not the big bestsellers in the commercial sense, you know. They're like discoveries, which is always nice for me.
My favourite book, you asked what my favourite book is.
John Chancer.
That's very difficult to say. I think the last count is I must have recorded about 430 books in the last 30-odd years, and I would say that it would be impossible for me to say which one would be the most favourite one. I can't tell you that, but thank you, and I hope your listeners will carry on enjoy reading all our lovely books at the RNIB.
Thanks to all of the narrators of RNIB Talking Books. For more information on the Talking Book service and to request specific books, you can head to www.rnib.org.uk/library. And in addition to that, I spoke to Talking Books narrator Steve Hodson at a separate event and asked him about his career at RNIB Talking Books.
Hello, I'm Steve Hodson. I had been away from London for years. I'd been up north doing a television programme. And I came back, and I'd only been back about 6 months, and I got a phone call from the man who then ran Talking Books. He was called Ian Turner. He said, "Would you like to do a book?" And I went, "Wow, yes." And so I did one. It's a tester, really. I think it was based up north. I was born in Yorkshire, so the accent was all right. And then I recorded that, and about a week or so later, when it had all been prepped, I got a phone call, "Would you like another?" And I said yes, and that was 1975. Even when I went away sort of filming or doing a telly or in theatre, I always had an RNIB book in my bag, either to prep, or I would phone the studios and say, "I've got Wednesday off, I've got a Friday off," and we'd fit. So you're constantly coming in. What's happened here is that I've been asked to do books that I'm not aware of the authors at all, but it's opened me up to them. So I have met new authors and through being here, and that's been fascinating as well. At the moment, I'm doing a book called Gallipoli, which is about the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War, written by a man called Alan Moorhead, a great historian. It's a fascinating book. The week before that, I was doing two young adults' books. You know, it really keeps the old brain box going, you know. Because you have to be authorial voice, you get to play the men, the women, the children, you have to be everybody. And be aware exactly of what the author's intending. So it's absolutely fascinating. It's, if you think about it too deeply, it's terrifying. And I've met a lot of blind people. I was once in the BBC club having done a play there. And the voice boomed across the bar saying, "You're Steve Hodson." And it was a blind guy with his guide dog. And he just heard my voice talking to someone. And he'd heard loads of books I'd done and things. And he came bounding across the BBC club. And we had a great night. You've got to talk to somebody like him to realise just how much it means. It means that a young historian can keep up with what's going on. Politicians. I mean, I've done all these things, you know. Having done this television series, you used to get fan mail. But I got fan mail from the blind reader. There's nothing like it in the world. You've opened up a whole new world. And books are my passion. I have the hugest personal library. I've got about 6,000 books, which my daughters are now stealing bit by bit. And be able to give that to somebody, oh, it just broke my heart and filled me full of pride as well. And when I decided that really, about 3 or 4 years ago, that I might start retiring and running down things, the one thing I could not give up for the life in me was RNIB. I love it. I've loved working for them throughout. I've seen so many different bosses and engineers and producers. It's been a magical time.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Available from RNIB Library Now is 59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman.
59 Seconds. Think a little, change a lot. Psychologist Professor Richard Wiseman exposes modern-day mind myths promoted by the self-help industry and presents a fresh approach to change that helps people achieve their aims and ambitions in minutes, not months.
A clip of 59 seconds available from the RNIB Talking Books Library by Professor Richard Wiseman. Now, Richard Wiseman, Professor of the Public Understanding of Psychology, said fear is a strange emotion. When it's genuine fear, we don't like it. But we do like to rehearse fear in a very safe environment, like watching scary movies or TV. So, Professor Wiseman, why do we enjoy what you're calling framed fear?
I think it's a very good question, and the research looked at exactly that question. And the answer is that when we are genuinely afraid, we have adrenaline pumping through the body as we get ready to run away or fight or whatever it is. But of course, that is in a negative situation. It is not an enjoyable emotion. What's interesting about roller coasters and scary radio shows and TV programs and so on is that you get the adrenaline, which is rather fun, the thrill of that, but you know deep down that you're in a safe environment. The zombies really aren't going to sort of jump out and actually start attacking you or whatever it is. So you have this kind of rehearsal of fear, but you have the upside of the adrenaline without the downside of actually being in a properly scary, threatening situation.
I suppose the same could be said for scary talking books as well.
Oh, absolutely. Anything. Where there is a sense of, you know, putting you in a different situation, a different context. We are humans incredibly good at imagining ourselves in a particular situation and telling stories to one another. It goes back, you know, many, many years to sitting around the fire telling stories and many of them being scary. That notion that we can absorb ourselves in a situation, believe that we're actually there, but yet deep down know that we're not, I think is a fascinating psychological state.
What was interesting in the research was the British men who would send their partners down to see to investigate a noise in the night.
It was a phenomenal finding. So this was asking the question, you know, what would you do if you're laying in bed with your partner and you heard a sort of banging downstairs or something? And 1 in 10 men said that what they would do is send their partner, maybe their wife, down to investigate, which is quite a novel approach to fear. You would have thought that, hopefully that they might have gone down to find out what's going on. So, yes, that really did kind of surprise us. And it made me laugh as well, actually.
And having a partner seems to be important for watching horror on TV.
Well, watching with others. And so a little bit like laughter, screaming is a social signal. So if you hear something funny and you're on your own, you don't tend to laugh. You obviously find it funny, but you don't laugh. If you're with others, you're far more likely to laugh. It's about letting people know that you got the joke and spreading merriment and so on. Exactly the same with all these sorts of scary experiences. You're more likely to jump and scream and do all those sorts of things, grab the other person and so on, obviously, if you're with others. And that then builds the experience for them because it becomes contagious and they send it back to you and so on. So even the way we respond to these things is actually unconscious. And again, there's a fascinating psychology around it. You'd think you're just screaming because you see something scary. Actually, you're screaming to let other people know you've seen something scary.
Now, I've done some research on talking to blind people about roller coasters, and is there a fear on a roller coaster when you can't actually see how high up you are? And the findings we got was the perception of speed is the scary thing. But do you think these jump scares and the things on TV work as well when you can't see them?
I suspect that some work even better and others don't work so well. So if you take away the visual medium, then obviously you're focusing on the auditory side of things. And so when you're looking at what I think is actually the best type of fear, which is where you're slowly getting drawn into the story, it isn't just somebody suddenly jumping out on the screen, which for me is a kind of cheap thrill. It's sort of like, of course, that's going to make you jump. But I think what's really wonderful about a Victorian ghost story is the one that slowly pulls you in, takes you into that world, and suddenly it's all rather uncanny, and you're not certain exactly what's going on. And I think The Voice is very naked for that, you know, because it just sort of takes you in, and you have to use your imagination to immerse yourself in that rather than a film which does all the work for you. I think that's a wonderful art form, and it's one which I think should be celebrated.
In TV and radio, dramas as well, you can't underestimate the importance of tense music as well, though.
Oh, absolutely. And also silence. I mean, if something is silent for a short period of time, that can be really quite tense for people because it is mimicking the genuine fear response, which is to go very quiet and go very still. But you can't have it for too long because it gets monotonous. So it's all about balance. I don't think we're ever going to come up with a formula for fear. You know, it's always going to be an art form. But yes, absolutely, the music that slowly draws you into it, absolutely crucial.
What about yourself? Are you a scare junkie?
For certain things, I'm not a roller coaster fan, but I do enjoy haunted houses. I love wandering through those, you know, those things that sort of have at fun fairs and so on. I love ghost trains. So it depends. I do enjoy some horror films, but they tend to be ones with a strong sense of narrative rather than the kind of jump scare ones, which don't really quite do it for me.
You yourself have a YouTube channel that came from your book Quirkology, and it seems to be very popular with children. Why is that?
I guess we have a lot of psychology on there, and so there's short videos which involve magic tricks or illusions or things that kids can do at home, and started about 10 years ago, actually. So YouTube has just been around for a couple of years when we started, and now we have about 2.5 million followers on it. And it's lovely. I get emails from kids all the time that say the reason why they're studying psychology is because they saw our Quirkology videos on YouTube. So it's a great way of getting psychology out there. Sometimes it makes you feel a little bit old when they're saying, oh, you know, I'm in my second year degree in psychology and I've been watching your videos since I was 10. But it's a wonderful way, I think, of spreading what is my passion, which is this just love of the human mind and trying to understand the beauty of our complexity, I think.
Now, where did that come from? Because a lot of them do involve not magic, but illusion.
Absolutely. So I used to work as a magician. So for many years, I was going around doing card tricks on stage, doing illusions. And you realize there's a huge amount of psychology within magic. You have to be a good psychologist to fool an audience. You have to know how they think and feel at any one particular moment. And that's how I got into psychology, because of that. So I have a rather odd career path. But I hope some of that passion will come across when people watch the videos and try the tricks out. And maybe, you know, some of those kids will then go, wow, this is interesting. And that will put them on a path to looking into the area a little bit more deeply.
And I've got a question from my son who says, what was the first magic trick you ever learned?
Oh, my goodness. The first one I ever learned, it was I used to go and visit my grandfather, and he would do a trick where I'd put my initials on a coin. It would disappear and appear in a box that was in his pocket. And I used to badger him, say, how on earth could you do this every single weekend? And he said eventually to me, he said, the answer is in the library. He said, there are books in the library on magic. It's in one of those books. So I went there, read everything, eventually found it. And that was the very first trick that I performed. And I still perform it, where the coin disappears, ends up in a box in your pocket. So it all goes back to me visiting my grandfather when I was about 8.
Now, we started off with a clip of your book, 59 Seconds, which is available in the RNIB library. Self-help that actually does work. Before we end, could you tell us why smiling when you're unhappy would help?
that's what's called the facial feedback hypothesis, that you would think that in terms of emotion and facial expression, it's a one-way street, that when you feel happy, you smile. And that is obviously true. However, it turns out that faking it, it turns out that our expressions also affect our emotions. So if you fake it and you put a smile on your face, it instantly cheers you up. It's one of the quickest ways of doing it. And so if people try now, if the listeners try it, just smile for around about 20 seconds, they will feel better. And that's what 59 seconds is about. These very quick things that are evidence-based that make a difference to how people think and feel.
Professor Richard Wiseman, thanks so much for joining us today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman is available as an RNIB talking book now, and his other books are available commercially from Audible. For more information on the talking book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Now it's back to Dr. Ranch for the books of his life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, gosh. I have so many fond memories from being a kid and books, because my mum used to take us down to the local library every week to make sure that we were immersed and surrounded by books. We didn't have the internet back then. So that was my sort of outlook and insight into the world, as it were. One thing that I remember I really, really loved, and it wasn't a particular book, it was a series, was the Asterix comics. Now, these were book/comics. And I kind of fell in love with them because the design and the format of those books was incredibly engaging, but also the humor was hilarious. And there were so many of them. And I learned, you know, a little bit about Roman history through them, like just on as a side thing. Yeah, I was fascinated by those Asterix books. And I used to just sit down and, you know, with a packet of crisps by the radiator and be quiet for hours on end. And I definitely, that's one of my fondest memories of being a kid and reading.
Once upon a time, over 2,000 years ago, the Romans had conquered most of the known world. Of course, not as much of the world was known then as it is now. For instance, people in Europe hadn't discovered Australia or America yet. As a matter of fact, Asterix the Gaul, the hero of the story you're about to hear, did once go to America, but by mistake, so it doesn't count. However, whenever the Romans heard about a new bit of the world, they set out to conquer it. You might perhaps say they were rather greedy, but they liked conquering things, and they nearly always succeeded in what they set out to do. So the Romans were definitely the top people of their time. They were particularly good at conquering under their famous military leader, Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was ruling Rome in the year 50 BC, when this story begins. By that time, the Roman army had reached Gaul, the country we now know as France. The Gauls put up a brave fight against the invaders, led by gallant chieftains such as the great Vercingetorix. There were skirmishes all over the hills and forests and countryside of Gaul. But in the end, the Gauls were overcome by the sheer weight of the Roman numbers. And if you've ever written out Roman numbers, you'll know how much more space they take up than the ordinary sort. What was more, the Romans had all the latest weapons and modern technology. For instance, they had great catapults on wheels for hurling huge missiles at the enemy. Long-range missiles travelling 100 yards or so. How could the poor Gauls hope to compete?
The Asterix the Gaul audiobooks were released in 1990 and only available on cassette, but someone has digitised them all and uploaded them to YouTube. Type Asterix the Gaul audiobook into the YouTube search engine, you'll find 8 books, 7 of which are read by Willie Rushton. The final one, Asterix and the Secret Weapon, is read by Andrew Sachs.
And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again for a comfort read?
Right now, I think. So I'm a huge fan of Charlie Makesy, who is an artist who's also turned his art into books. A friend of mine gave me The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, which is a book that you can dip in and out of. And it's not written like a storybook or anything like that. It is little anecdotes, little life lessons. I dip into that every now and again because it just makes you sit and think. Even if you read one page and look at one thing, you can sit there and reflect and think for ages. And that's the book I go back to at the moment.
In their wanderings, they meet the fox. As you can imagine, it's never going to be easy meeting a fox if you're a mole. The boy is full of questions, and the mole is greedy for cake. The fox is mainly silent and wary because he's been hurt by life. The horse is the biggest thing they've ever encountered, and also the gentlest. They're all different like us, and each has their own weaknesses. I can see myself in all 4 of them. Perhaps you can too. Their adventures happen in springtime, where one moment snow is falling and the sun shines the next, which is also a little bit like life. It can turn on a sixpence. I hope this book encourages you, perhaps, to live courageously with more kindness for yourself and others, and to ask for help when you need it, which is always a brave thing to do. When I was making the book, I often wondered, who on earth am I to be doing this? But as the horse says, the truth is, everyone is winging it. So I say, spread your wings and follow your dreams. Making this book is one of mine. Thank you for joining me on this adventure, and much love to you.
A clip from the introduction to The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, written and narrated by Charlie Makesy, and is available commercially now.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently you'd like to recommend?
Ooh, I get sent books all the time and I kind of flick through them and have a read whenever I can. The book that's by my on my bedside table right now is a book that a friend gave me called Ceremony by Brianna West. Brianna West is an American author. She's written lots of books and they're kind of, the only way I can describe it, it's not story or prose or anything like that. And it's not written as a narrative. Each page has like a life lesson on it. And it might be a couple of paragraphs. It might be a poem. It might be, a story from somewhere in her life. Or it might just be as short as a few lines, but they are life lessons about yourself, about love, about who you are and how you feel. And it makes me think, which is why I like it so much. And it makes you feel good. And I think it was self-published actually, but it's done so brilliantly well. And I've recommended it to other people. And that Ceremony by Brianna West, it is really, really beautifully done.
Ceremony by Brianna West isn't available as yet in audio, but three of her other books are available commercially. The Human Element, The Truth About Everything, and 101 Essays That Will Change the Way You Think. It's read by Abby Creighton.
Remedy your tunnel vision by writing your narrative on a piece of paper. Start with, "My name is," and then go on to list where you live, what work you do, what you've accomplished, who you spend time with, what you're working on, what you're proud of. 7. Realize that thoughts are illusions, but powerful ones. Take inventory of all the things you've thought and worried about that have turned out not to be real. Think of all the time you wasted preparing for outcomes that would never manifest and problems that were only in your head.
Clip from 101 Essays That Will Change the Way You Think by Brianna West.
Brain Power by Dr. Ranj, a toolkit to understand and train your unique brain, is available in print and audio now. And Dr. Ranj, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at Talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.